It was a reference echoed in a story by Matt Cooper of Time magazine published 3 days after Novak's column on July 17, 2003. Cooper wrote that some government officials had told Time about Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, and speculated about the administration's motives for spreading the word about Plame. Has the Bush administration declared war on a former ambassador who conducted a fact-finding mission to probe possible Iraqi interest in African uranium? Perhaps. Cooper also quoted Joe Wilson, who had no doubts about what he believed the administration was doing. This is a smear job, Wilson insisted. Whether war, smear job, or PR offensive gone haywire, the CIA took the leak of Plame's name very seriously. A couple of weeks later, around the end of July, in an undisclosed letter to the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, the CIA reported a possible violation of criminal law concerning the unauthorized disclosure of classified information, and informed Justice that its Office of Security was investigating the matter. Already battling attacks about its offensive tactics, the Niger claim and the hyping of pre-war intelligence generally, the Bush administration would soon have to answer questions about its defensive tactics, leaking Valerie Plame's identity in an effort to beat back her husband's assaults. And in the midst of all this, on July 15th, just one day after Novak's column, neither aware of the leaks nor previously involved in the effort to discredit Wilson, I took over Ari Fleischer's job as White House press secretary. If I'd been expecting a honeymoon, I quickly learned otherwise. On my second day as press secretary, presidential counselor Dan Bartlett, my fellow Texan and the man in charge of overall communications for the White House, conducted an important planning meeting for relevant staff under his purview. Its purpose was to make sure that the White House communications team was intently focused on the need to win every news cycle and make sure we were contributing to the broader strategic plan during the upcoming re-election effort. This directive was coming directly out of the White House strategery meeting that had just been held around that time. As we met, the 16 words controversy was continuing to dog us, and now that we'd acknowledged that the uranium claim was probably false, we were stuck defending the indefensible, not a good place for the president and his White House team to be. We needed to refocus the debate on the larger strategic framework, the big picture of national security that the president would relentlessly push during the re-election campaign against his eventual opponent, Senator John Kerry. At the meeting, Bartlett outlined the winning message. The president's most important obligation, particularly in a post-9/11 world, is to protect the American people from terrorist and outlaw regimes. The way to win this war on terror is to stay on the offensive, ending threats by confronting them, and a peaceful, freer, and more stable Middle East is key to our own safety and security. Our job was all about keeping the focus on national security, and specifically the war on terrorism, which would become the central theme of the president's re-election campaign. In this context, the war in Iraq was not only justifiable, but essential. Saddam Hussein's regime had been a threat before the invasion, whether it had WMD or not. Now we were dismantling al-Qaeda, and we were fighting a broad war on terror in both Afghanistan and Iraq. For the next 10 weeks, every significant opportunity on the president's schedule would be used for pushing this message. Republicans in Congress and allies in the media, such as conservative columnists and talk radio personalities, would be enlisted in the effort and given communications packets with comprehensive talking points aimed at helping them pivot to the message whenever they could. Daily talking points and regular briefings for members and staff would be provided, and rapid, same news cycle response to any attacks or negative press would be a top priority, an effort Bartlett had spearheaded during the 2000 campaign. It was a determined campaign to seize the media offensive and shape or manipulate the narrative to our advantage. But the 16 words controversy refused to go away. How had the apparently mistaken claim about uranium from Africa found its way into the State of the Union address? If Tenet's CIA was responsible, shouldn't Tenet suffer some consequences? If not, who should? Questions like these came up in almost every press gaggle and briefing. And as the days went by, it became increasingly clear that they had to be dealt with decisively, and the sooner the better. It was White House Chief of Staff Andy Card and Presidential Counselor Dan Bartlett who ultimately took charge of resolving this dilemma. Andy, by directing everyone on the White House staff to provide all relevant recollections and documents tracing the genesis and handling of the uranium claim, And Dan, by organizing the information and developing a clear, forthright presentation that showed how such an egregious error occurred. For people like Dan and me, charged with handling communications on behalf of a complex organization like the White House, tension between us and our clients and the news media is a basic part of the job description. When the people in charge, from the president on down, are secure in their roles and committed to maximum openness, that tension is diminished. We're permitted to share information with relative freedom, and we're usually able to overcome resistance to openness from those, especially the lawyers and some other top advisors, who tend to be overly cautious or prefer secrecy. But when our leaders choose not to embrace openness and erect roadblocks in the path of full disclosure, the tension is aggravated. This can make our job almost unbearable. More important, it may ultimately undermine an administration and even the president himself. In most organizations, including the Bush administration, there are people on both sides of this issue, those who favor disclosure and those who abhor it. Artfully managing the tug of war between different factions is also part of our job. And in today's world of the 24-hour news cycle, time pressures complicate the challenge enormously. Speed is always desirable when releasing information, but getting all the facts can take time. When the information is incomplete, the media may fill the void with emotion-rousing partisan rhetoric that provides conflict, controversy, and negativity, and too often, whether deliberately or unconsciously, jumps to oversimplified, black-and-white conclusions that define a storyline before the whole nuanced truth can be uncovered. The story behind the 16 words controversy was a complicated one, and because we at the White House were a little slow in getting important facts together and sharing them, it kept burning into my second week as press secretary. On July 18th, 2 days after our communications meeting, Bartlett provided some facts about the controversy on background to reporters. Part of the October NIE, including the paragraphs related to Iraqi attempts to obtain uranium from Africa, were officially declassified through CIA channels and released at the same time. But our internal investigation was incomplete at that time, and the meager facts Dan shared didn't satisfy the media. Over the next few days, more documents were unearthed, and the full story of the uranium claim gradually came into focus. On July 21st, there was a late-night gathering among select senior advisors in Andy Card's office to discuss our communication strategy for dealing with the issue. Present were Card, Bartlett, Condi Rice and Deputy Steve Hadley, White House Counsel Alberto Gonzalez, Staff Secretary Harriet Myers, and myself. One topic of discussion was a detail that had turned up in a story by White House correspondent Richard W. Dick Stevenson in the New York Times 8 days before. According to that story, a claim that Saddam Hussein had tried to buy 550 tons of uranium ore from Niger had been dropped from a speech given by President Bush in Cincinnati back on October 7, 2002. CIA Director George Tenet, the story said, had personally warned Deputy National Security Advisor Steve Hadley that the claim couldn't be supported by solid intelligence. If true, this raised an obvious question. Why would a claim deemed too flimsy for a speech in Cincinnati be given a place in the president's most prominent message to the American people, the State of the Union address? Most people on the outside are not familiar with Hadley, but those of us who work with him know him to be an honorable man. His behavior that evening only reaffirmed the fact. Hadley confirmed having the conversation with Tenet, but 3 months later, when the State of the Union address was being finalized, he'd forgotten about it. On reflection, he felt that he should have recalled the conversation and Tenet's warnings about the Niger claim. Signing off on these facts is my responsibility, Steve said, and in this case, I blew it. I think the only solution is for me to resign. Hadley had been particularly upset that Tenet had been made to look like the scapegoat, since he believed it was nobody's fault but his own. Intra-administration squabbling and finger-pointing among agencies was one of the few things that visibly disturbed Hadley's calm, deliberate, and thoughtful demeanor. The offer to resign was his notably selfless attempt to clear the name of someone he felt had taken an unfair degree of blame and to accept his own responsibility for an honest mistake whose consequences were now playing out before a worldwide audience. As I sat considering Hadley's words, his proposal was rejected almost out of hand by others present. Hadley was one of the most loyal members of the Bush team and a valued advisor, and his mistake had hardly been a hanging offense. but we agreed that an approach of openness, forthrightness, and honesty was now essential. Bartlett and Hadley, the two White House staffers most directly familiar with the speech vetting process and the facts in this case, would be the best ones to inform the world as to what had happened and why. And only Hadley could correct the record about where responsibility rested for the 16 words getting into the president's address. The next day, in the Roosevelt Room of the White House, Bartlett and Hadley briefed reporters about how the 16 words had been permitted to appear in the State of the Union address. As the White House Communications Director, Bartlett had overseen the speechwriting process. As the number two NSC official, Hadley was the point person for signing off on the factual content of speeches in his area of expertise. Acknowledging Tenet's earlier request not to include the Niger claim, Hadley told the assembled reporters he had failed in his responsibility for vetting the speech. The fact is that given the October 5th and 6th CIA memorandum and my telephone conversation with a DCI Tenet at roughly the same time, I should have recalled at the time of the State of the Union speech that there was controversy associated with the uranium issue. The Bartlett-Hadley briefing lasted an hour and 23 minutes. I imagine it felt longer for Steve, but it accomplished our goal of putting the 16 words controversy behind us. Yet this was only one of the battles we in the White House faced. The broader question about pre-war intelligence continued to loom. Why had the Bush administration, along with so many other well-informed experts from many nations, been so badly mistaken about the status of Saddam's WMD and WMD programs? What's more, the new conflict over the apparent leak of Valerie Plame's identity by administration officials bent on discrediting Joe Wilson would soon heat up. On September 16th, the CIA informed the Justice Department about its completed investigation into the disclosure of Valerie Plame's name and undercover status, and requested that the FBI initiate an investigation of this matter. Justice advised the CIA on September 29, 2003, that its counterespionage section supported the request for an investigation. The clear implication was that there was good reason to believe a crime had been committed in the leaking of Plame's name. The White House would be informed about the Justice Department decision later that evening. The Made for Washington scandal was now fully grown. It was taking place against the backdrop of a high-stakes presidential re-election campaign. Partisanship permeated the controversy, even to the name of the story. We at the White House referred to it simply as the leak investigation, while our critics called it Plamegate, in an effort to make it sound as sinister as the best-known political scandal of all. Perhaps the hottest question surrounding the leak investigation was whether Karl Rove, arguably the Bush administration's most controversial official, had been involved. I was first asked specifically whether Rove had been involved in the leak late in the briefing on September 16, 2003. Russell McIver, editor of the advocacy newsletter Corporate Crime Reporter, a Ralph Nader associate and liberal White House critic, asked a pointed question. It came out of the blue, but that was normal for the gruff McIver, who usually wasn't interested in the news of the day. He was interested in gotcha reporting, plain and simple, to damage an administration he held in low regard.